Hey, welcome back to Coast AM. I could listen to Louis Prima all night. Let me just take a few moments here before we get back to our conversation with Rick Strassman, author of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. I want to talk to you a little bit about Coast to Coast AM's Coast Insider Club. Now, I know a lot of you, you're listening right now. You are not night owls, but you have friends and family and colleagues, and they are not night owls. So you need to let them in on this great little secret called the Coast Insider Club. And for about 15 cents a day, they can listen to last night's show. They can have it. They can have this show waiting for them on their desktop in the morning and listen to it when they're feeling refreshed. And they can go back and access 5 years worth of archived shows, thousands and thousands of shows. Plus, they get access to the monthly live chats with George and other guests. And it's real simple. All they have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up. Tell them to do it now. Back with more of my conversation with Rick Strassman as we delve into DMT and the Soul of Prophecy right here on Coast to Coast AM. Back to Coast AM, Rick Strassman, MD, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, a new science of spiritual revelation in the Hebrew Bible. So, Rick, as you're sitting next to these subjects they are having these DMT experiences, were you open to the possibility that, for example, these visual effects they're having, encounters with angelic beings and so forth, were you open to the possibility that these experiences were not just products of the brain, that they were real, they were experiencing another level of reality?
Well, not really, because all three of the models that I brought to bear on the research posited their unreality. One of the models was the brain chemistry model. In other words, your brain was generating these perceptions as a result of getting DMT. It was your brain on drugs, as it were. The other model, was a psychoanalytic model. And it also, posited that the things that the volunteers were apprehending were products of psychology, unconscious conflicts or impulses which were being, actualized or, manifested, visually or auditorially. And the Buddhist model also, posited the basic unreality of the visions. It suggested that the things that people were seeing and hearing and feeling or thinking were mental, byproducts, as it were, on the way towards a formless, unitive, concept-free state of enlightenment. When I was interacting with the volunteers and, gathering as much information as I could about their drug sessions, I think, my skepticism or, my, foundational approach, began to impact the volunteers and, they could tell, that I was, considering what they were talking about as unreal. One of the most striking characteristics of the DMT experience is its, sense of, it feels extremely real, perhaps more real than everyday reality. So my skepticism, as it were, began to began to close the avenues of conversation between me and the volunteers. And I was noticing that, and the volunteers were as well. So I kind of had to suspend, disbelief at a certain point and engage in a thought experiment and, say to myself, it could be real what they're experiencing. I don't understand, how that could be the case. And I could go back to the drawing board afterwards and look for models that might be able to contain, that kind of, belief. But in the meantime, I will start to approach, people's experiences as if they're a, new, level of reality, that they're seeing as opposed to generating.
You begin the book with one of the subjects, an experience that Leo had. And because you, I want to get an example from you when you describe their experience as being more real than reality. Could you use Leo as an example and tell us what Leo experienced under DMT?
Well, sure. Well, so Leo was a psychologist in his mid to late 30s. Yeah, you know, so he, you know, was volunteer, received the DMT, and, you know, he described the typical rush, you know, the lightness of the body, you know, fear of fainting or, you know, like an intimation of, you know, fainting. And his body became, you know, quite light on the way, you know, to the dissociation of consciousness, you know, from the body. And he also described an interesting auditory effect. It was extremely quiet, but at the same time, you know, there was a, you know, like an after effect of a large, you know, bell ringing. Even though he couldn't actually, you know, hear the bell, he still, you know, he still experienced the after effects of a large bell ringing, if that makes any sense. Yeah, and, you know, so then he, you know, beheld this flaming waterfall of color, and out of this flaming waterfall emerged a handful of these beings, probably, you know, 3 feet tall, you know, 4 feet tall, you know, composed of light as well. And, you know, they kind of emerged out from this, you know, cascading waterfall of light. And they saw him, and, you know, he saw them. So they said to him in you know, kind of a sing-song voice, you know, now do you see? Now do you see? And he, you know, described a, you know, feeling of, you know, being slack-jawed, as it were, like his, you know, jaw, you know, dropped open, or his, you know, psychological jaw dropped open. Yeah, and, you know, after a few, you know, moments of an exchange like that, they, you know, receded back into the waterfall.
And during the exchange, the interaction, the relationship between the subject and these angelic beings or these visual effects for the materialists out there, was there any sort of exchange of profound information? I mean, the content of the message coming from these angelic beings?
In a way, no. No, it was more... it was more the impact. You know, there were these beings who seemed extremely powerful, and, you know, they were kind of, you know, and, you know, they were kind of, you know, boring this, you know, question into his brain, his consciousness. You know, but it was a question as opposed to an answer. And, you know, he felt completely, you know, blown away, you know, by the contact itself. But with respect to the content, you know, what was the information that the beings were trying to convey other than, you know, their existence? And in respect to those kinds of issues, I don't think he actually... you know, came back with all that much.
And were there common denominators with the subjects? For example, did they all see these cascading waterfalls, angelic beings emerging from these cascading waterfalls? Were there common elements or common denominators that sort of connected some dots for you?
You know, it's interesting, you know, the commonalities, you know, it's a, you know, it, you know, seems like, you know, the entry into a, you know, fairly recognizable and, you know, reproducible kind of world. You know, there's really, you know, bright lights. And, you know, sometimes, you know, they, you know, might be, you know, composed of, you know, waterfall-like imagery. But, you know, by and large, you know, the more, you know, generic description would be, you know, rapidly moving, you know, rapidly morphing, incredibly, saturated and bright. So if the beings or other, formed objects were part of the experience, it was quite common for, people to describe them as emerging, from that, matrix of color.
At what point, Rick, did you abandon the Buddhist philosophical model or spiritual tradition as a way of sort of explaining the DMT experience and sort of revert back to your roots and go to the Old Testament and the prophets, the Hebrew prophets?
Yeah, it was kind of a difficult thing to work through, because Buddhism influenced my study in a number of ways. For example, the rating scale, which I developed, it was a new paper and pencil test that people would fill out after they came down from the drug effect. It was composed, or it was conceived of using Buddhist psychological principles, and using that questionnaire, I was able to quantify the subjective effects of DMT extremely carefully, and that's been an extremely valuable rating scale. A number of other groups around the country and around the world have been using it for other drugs as well. So it's been performing and holding up, quite well after even 20 years. And also, Buddhism influenced our style of, supervising, people's, drug sessions. I would go into a, light meditative state, and I taught my nurse to go into a, light meditative state, during, the volunteers, experiences, in order to be, I'm alert, but I'm also non-intrusive, so that, was an influence as well. So the model, though, the understanding of, the drug effect as illusory or as hallucinatory, was a problem. Also, the interactive, quality of the state, wasn't what, wasn't what, I expected. If a big dose of DMT was going to lead to an enlightenment experience. And it was also, different than the volunteers' expectations, who, mostly came from an Eastern religious, kind of background. So I kind of held on to, certain aspects of, Buddhism, but, discarded others. And it was only after I completed this, the DMT book, The Spirit Molecule, that I started to, look around, for other models.
And why then the Hebrew prophets in the Old Testament?
It came about for a couple of reasons. Like as I was growing up and as a monastery was growing up, I was still speaking with them regarding my interest in these states, in these drugs, and their relationship to Buddhism and the Buddhist enlightenment experience. And I was encouraged, over the space of over 20 years or so to continue, going deeper, understanding what was going on. But as time went on and I was actually, doing the research and, beginning to write about the relationship between, psychedelics and enlightenment and, Buddhist practice, it became increasingly strained, between the monastic community and myself, because of the taint of drugs and those kinds of things. And so after a certain point we parted ways, over these issues. And so the silver lining was, it gave me an opportunity, to return to my own roots, and I began to look at the Hebrew Bible, for a couple of reasons. One is I, was interested in the spiritual nourishment which might be found there, and I was also able to approach it as an adult, with some Buddhist background, I could stay, you know, focused. I could deal with the, you know, with the emotional reactions, you know, to the Bible's text. And as time went on, I was reading about encounters of the prophetic figures in the Bible, and you know, they seemed you know, quite similar, you know, to the descriptions of my DMT volunteers.
And could you give me an example? Let's say from let's go to the book of Ezekiel. Could you give me an example of where a Hebrew prophet, a passage that seems to mirror almost a DMT experience?
Yes. Well, in the first, you know, in you know, the beginning of the book of Ezekiel is a description of his initiatory vision, and he's standing by a river. I'm in the heavens. Split open, and he, you know, perceives flashes of light and lightning and thunder, on the sound of, you know, rushing waters, you know, the sound of a multitude, and you know, then these beings emerge, you know, from this amorphous, you know, visual matrix. You know, they're extremely powerful. He, you know, describes them as beings, you know, rather like angels.
This is starting to sound like Leo's experience.
Well, and he's completely floored. He, you know, falls to his face. He can't even stand up. The beings speak to him, and you know, they say, "I'm going to speak to you now." And you know, they grab him, and you know, they pull him up to space, and you know, they show him things. They're spinning wheels, they're spinning globes. Yeah, you know, so it's quite DMT-like.
And so, but the one of the primary differences, I would think, is that the information that's imparted to Ezekiel and other prophets is quite profound, which is sort of lacking in the DMT experience, correct?
Yeah, you know, one of the beauties of the Bible is it's a, you know, prophetic religion, and you know, to the extent, you know, that the prophetic state resembles the, you know, DMT one, you know, one can call it a, you know, almost psychedelic. You know, but as opposed to the DMT state, or even the psychedelic state in general, you know, the Bible is, you know, full of content. You know, the vocabulary, the images, the, you know, the concepts all have, you know, they're, you know, it's, you know, extremely detailed, quite complex, you know, highly articulated, and extremely, extremely influential. You know, look at the impact of the Hebrew Bible's, you know, message, you know, on, well, on our civilization, our law, our ethics, economy, you know, science, art, you know, theology.
Certainly. What do you mean? What do you mean by prophecy? When I think of prophecy, I think of these biblical figures making predictions. But prophecy is much larger than that, isn't it?
Well, yes, and I am glad you bring that up. Yeah, because you know most people think so most people you know think of you know prophecy as predicting or foretelling. You know, but. You know, my definition is you know quite a bit you know more broad. I define you know the prophetic experience as any experience of you know visions or voices encountered you know by you know someone in the Hebrew Bible. You know, so that could include could include the canonical prophets like Ezekiel, Isaiah, you know, Jeremiah, you know, those people. It also can include any, you know, nameless, you know, faceless person, you know, who encounters an angel on the way.
Or Moses in the burning bush, of course.
Yes, or even Adam and Eve, you know, they speak with God, you know, so, you know, one could, you know, call them, well, you know, people that experience, you know, the prophetic state as well.
Sure. All right. We'll take a time out. And when we come back, we're going to open up the lines for questions and comments for Rick Strassman, MD, author of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, a new science of spiritual revelation in the Hebrew Bible, no less. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Carly Simon and You're So Vain bringing us back in from the break. And, of course, that's one of the great debates that rages in the music world. Who was she singing about? Was it Warren Beatty? Or the other the name that tops the list is Mick Jagger. Was it Warren Beatty or Mick Jagger? And I'm not sure. Carly Simon may have dated them both. But then I discovered not too long ago, you probably already knew this because you're so astute, but I didn't. Mick Jagger is actually singing background vocals in that song. And once you hear his voice, you can't miss it. But you got to hear it first. And then I'm thinking, wait a minute. Why would Mick Jagger be in a song called You're So Vain if the song is about him? And then, of course, it's so obvious because he's so vain. He probably thinks the song is about him and he wants to sing in a song that's about him. All right. We will get back to my interview with Rick Strassman, author of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, and your questions and comments. I just wanted to bring your attention to another great story featured on the In the News section at coasttocoastam.com. This is kind of scary. It's a story about lie detectors or polygraph-based lie detection. And the technology of polygraphs has pretty much remained the standard method of deceit spotting in the government. But MRI-based lie detection systems are better so long as you can get the person you're evaluating over to a huge neural imager and you can afford the $2,600 per scan. But what the national security community has long wanted is lie detection systems that work in the field and can be deployed anywhere and can spot deceit on site and immediately. A polygraph encoded in software. In February, the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA, announced a rather unique competition called INSTINCT, which stands for Investigating Novel Statistical Techniques to Identify Neurophysiological Correlates of Trustworthiness. Great name. The goal was to develop innovative algorithms that can use data from one participant to accurately predict whether their partner will make trusting decisions and or act in a trustworthy manner. I can just see it now. Spouses all over, you know, scrambling to see if they can get this software and use it on their partner at breakfast. Do we really want this kind of technology to go commercial? I don't know. Could cause a lot of upset in the marital world. All right, back to my conversation with Rick Strassman, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, when Coast to Coast AM continues in a moment. Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Rick Strassman is with us, the author of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. Before we get to the calls, Rick, so what's the takeaway here? Are you suggesting that the Hebrew prophets, Ezekiel, Daniel, other Old Testament figures like Moses, were under the influence of DMT when they had these prophetic experiences?
excuse me. So I speculate in my new book that perhaps elevated endogenous levels of DMT are one of the mechanisms by which the visions and the voices and other specific characteristics of the prophetic state may be taking place. And the stimulus, though, for the elevation of endogenous DMT, is obviously the most important question. And
excuse the interruption, but when you say endogenous, you mean naturally occurring within the body, correct?
Right, right.
Okay.
Naturally occurring, made in the human body. Yeah, the contemporary models, for looking at the biology of religious experiences, what is called called neurotheology. In other words, the brain is generating the impression of divine communication. Almost like a reflex in the brain in response to specific stimuli like prayer or meditation or even drugs. And in my current, book, I'm speculating of a new model, which I call theoneurology. And I describe that as a top-down model, In other words, the deity or the divine or God, whatever you want to call it, is communicating, to humans using the brain. And, DMT is, one of, the potential mechanisms, by which that happens. So the stimulation of naturally occurring, DMT, could be the result of, godly influence, overflowing onto the person. Or it, could be a result of, meditation or prayer or fasting, in which case, the individual would be in the more receptive state, to divine influence.
So the creator, the divine God, is using DMT as a method of communication.
Yes. So the DMT, would be the mechanism, by which, the visions occur. But the content of the vision, the information, which is being, communicated or is embedded in the visions is, godly in origin.
So that would mean, if that's the case, then these Old Testament figures, these Hebrew prophets, must have had elevated levels of DMT coursing through their veins. I mean, is that not the case?
Well, it's purely speculation at so many levels, but still, to the extent that the prophetic state and the DMT state resemble each other, it is tempting to speculate that there is some common underlying biological denominator.
So then why do we not have more prophecy today? Why don't we have more, Ezekiels and Daniels and Moses, roaming the streets today?
Well, for a number of reasons. One of them is, political in some ways. The rabbis, legislated the end of prophecy over 2,000 years ago. There were a number of reasons, for them documenting that or legislating that. And also, at the same time, though, the prophetic experience, remained important, to the rabbis, and especially in, Kabbalah. You read the descriptions of what occurs as a result of specific, practices within Kabbalah. And it's, it's quite psychedelic. But I think it's a, question of education and of training, as much as, the state itself. I mean, there are plenty of, people, doing drugs and, taking, meditation, courses and experiencing a lot of altered states, through any number of, techniques, but there isn't, the appreciation of, the prophetic tradition. It, kind of, went out, it was an example of the baby being tossed with the bathwater in the 60s, when people started to experience these states, but ignored, their own tradition. So it seems to me, if my DMT, volunteers, were more acquainted with, some of the notions of the Hebrew Bible, the concept of angels, how to interact with angelic beings, what kind of questions to ask them, how, to interact with them, understand, the answers, that they're getting. The vocabulary, the techniques, the notions, it, could have, been the case that, they could have extracted a lot more meaning, from their sessions.
It could be also cultural. I mean, let's face it, if Ezekiel and Daniel and Isaiah were wandering and Jeremiah were wandering around today having these prophetic experiences and talking about them, they'd be locked up.
Well, they could be locked up. Exactly. Yeah. So, one of the other, concepts explanations, for the end of, prophecy is, is that God willed it. God has withheld prophecy. But at the same time, I've, kind of relied on I'm on the medievalists in my thinking about how to explain the mechanisms of the prophetic state, and so they talk about this notion of being qualified for prophecy. Even if it's currently being withheld as a result of some divine decision, at the same time we can become as qualified as possible in order to deserve it or to be able to experience it in the future.
All right, are you ready to dip into some calls, Rick?
Yes.
Let's begin with the wild card line, and Jill is in Buffalo, New York. Hello, Jill. Good morning, and welcome to Coast AM.
Oh, hello. Hello, Rick and Richard. Richard, I have, if it's okay, I have a two-part question related to increasing one's own endogenous DMT. Would you indulge me if I make it short?
I shall indulge.
Okay. Rick, you'd stated that tryptophan, of course, was necessary. People can get that by taking tryptophan supplement or eating dark turkey. And then you'd mentioned that two methyl groups would need to be, I think you said, added to it. And the first question is, some people have difficulty with this body process called methylation. And I was wondering if a good ability to methylate would be what would be required to add the methyls to that tryptophan.
Yeah, that's a good question. When people were looking at the possible relationship between DMT and schizophrenia, there was this complex theory called the methylation theory of schizophrenia. In other words, schizophrenics were over methylating their tryptamine, and that was causing too much DMT in the system. It was an extremely interesting area of research, but it got shut down at the same time as all other human studies did. One point that's important to keep in mind is that the concentrations of DMT in the blood and urine are extremely low, of the order of a billionth of a gram per per milliliter, and we still quite aren't able to measure levels of endogenous DMT yet. People talk about increasing their DMT by meditation or through exercises of some sort or another, but that still isn't established to actually increase endogenous levels of DMT.
All right, Jill, you had a follow-up to that?
The second part was pretty quick. It's something that's been really in vogue and everyone's been questioning. If the pineal gland of the rodents was found to have levels of DMT, there's always conjecture that that's the case with human beings, and some people think that pineal gland actually does make it. And the problem is there's so much chatter out there about pineal glands being really harmed in terms of just being intuitive in general by fluoride. And I don't know if this is a jump, but there seems to be a connection between wanting to decalcify the pineal gland, maybe because of fluorides, to make it function better. And I was wondering if you had any ideas about how to restore the pineal gland's health.
See, that's an interesting question.
Yeah,
thank you for that,
Jeff. And it's a question that I receive every month or so, through the email. Even if the pineal is completely eliminated, let's say from a stroke or from pineal cancer or an adjacent tumor, the lungs are still, the main organ producing DMT. I think that one can have a normal spiritual life, dream normally, those kinds of things, even without a pineal gland. And with respect to decalcifying the pineal, I'm, not familiar with any techniques that actually do that.
All right, Jill, thank you for the call from Buffalo. Let's go to the wild card line again, and it's Anita in New York City this time. Hello, Anita. Good morning.
Yes,
welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, gentlemen. Great show. Richard. Let me just first briefly say that I believe prophecy also means a warning. So it's something that, you know, if we could get humans to wake up, it could be changed. But I have a brief four-part question for Rick, and I'd like him to jot down my concerns, and I'll listen over the air. First, I'd like his thoughts on what he thought that the Soma, the ancients spoke of, they're using Soma, S-O-M-A. I'd like him to say what he thinks that was. And also, certain researchers and lay people, and there's an association, I believe they publish a journal, have adopted the word entheogen versus a psychedelic, using the psychedelic term. So I'm sure he's familiar with that, and he was getting on to God-reaching or God-seeking or God-divining. So I like his thoughts on entheogen instead of using psychedelic. I'd like to know what his, well, first capsulize the work of Michael Persinger in Canada, I believe it's in Toronto, where he's sort of seemed to have duplicated your results by using implants in the brain where people have out of body, and I believe they see these entities. So tell us about Michael Persinger. And lastly, Richard, you mentioned ayahuasca in South America. And I like his thoughts on that. But also, in particular, iboga out of Gabon, West Africa, that's been very effectively used by activists to cure all sorts of addictions. It's a plant probably with plenty of DMT, but we can see what his thoughts are on iboga or ibogaine. And I'll
right, listen
over the air if he got my questions.
Great questions, they are, Anita. Yeah. And she mentioned Michael Persinger, who I believe is up in Sudbury at Laurentian University, which is a few hours from Toronto. And I believe his book was The God Particle.
Yeah, well, I could start with you know, Persinger's work. Well, so he developed this thing called a God Helmet, and it stimulates the brain using, you know, magnetic fields. And, you know, some, you know, people, you know, that, well, you know, some people, so some individuals in his research experienced some DMT-like effects. And I've corresponded with Michael Persinger off and on over the years. And I've been trying to get some, you know, blood samples or some urine samples from his, you know, subjects, but we still haven't quite gotten there. You know, but it is an area of interest, you know, which is, you know, which overlaps, you know, with the DMT work.
And Persinger is coming at it from a more of a materialist point of view, correct? That he thinks that these experiences, these psychedelic or mystical experiences can be sort of artificially induced. Is that the idea?
He's, you know, coming at it from the bottom up, as it were. You know, if you stimulate the brain, then certain things happen. You know, and it is true, if you stimulate the brain, certain things do happen. But, you know, what is it that's happening? Are you just, you know, kind of zapping a TV set?
Right. Just because you can duplicate the effect doesn't mean that the effect isn't real.
That's right. And also, you know, if you consider... if you consider, you know, the proximal origin too.
Let me jump in here, Rick. We've got to take a time out. We'll come back and dip into some more phone calls. For Rick Strassman, author of DMT and The Soul of Prophecy, right here on Coast to Coast AM.